Do you ever feel like your brain just has too many tabs open? You can't focus, relax, or sleep soundly? For me, I was looking for something to help me focus without looking to another cup of coffee. And don't get me wrong though, there's still plenty of coffee involved. About 7 years ago though, I found Brain.fm, functional music designed by neuroscientists to help you achieve whatever state of mind you need. Brain.fm uses cutting-edge science to create music that actually changes your brainwave patterns. Need to focus on that looming deadline? Their focus program can help you achieve laser focus so you can get things done. Feeling stressed after a long day? Their relaxed program can melt away tension and leave you feeling calm. And for a restful night's sleep, their sleep program uses scientifically proven soundscapes to lull you into a deep, restorative slumber. All it takes is 15 minutes of listening to kickstart the neural entrainment and get you going. Now, I'm happy to say that I partnered with Brain.fm, and if you use my coupon code PRGSCOACH when you sign up, you'll get 20% off of your subscription. Head over to Brain.fm when you're ready to achieve greater control over your state of mind. Welcome to the Progress Over Perfection Coaching Podcast, where we talk about career management and development by offering insight on how to build an intentionally balanced and purpose-filled career. Today, I'm joined by Jessica Lackey. Jessica is a McKinsey Consulting, Nike, and Electrolux veteran that has over 10 years of senior leadership experience and is now a self-proclaimed ex-corporate warrior that has rejected the prevalent business environments that celebrate toxic productivity, hustle culture, and the idea of self-worth being defined by one's ability to climb the corporate ladder and contribute to the bottom line. Now, Jessica coaches and consults individuals and small businesses to help them succeed by imparting her business knowledge and people-centric wisdom to help unlock resonant and sustainable growth strategies. Without further ado, let's get into our conversation with Jessica. Here with another career deep dive episode, and I have with me Jessica Lackey. So Jessica, thanks so much for being on.
Excited to be here. Thanks for asking me to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. So like I like to start most of these episodes, share a quick anecdote about kind of how we met or what I first remember. So we were both working at Nike and introduced from a mutual friend. I was interested in learning more about S&OP and IBP and kind of like most informational one-on-one meetings, kind of like a blind date. So you kind of go and you don't know anything about somebody. And I just remember the very first thing, it was very disarming in a really positive way. I felt really comfortable getting to know you after this. I just remember you saying like, hey, you stopped. You're like mid-sentence and you stopped. And you're like, I'm really sorry. I'm reading a lot of Harry Potter right now and I'm having a hard time not shifting into a fake British accent. So if I'm processing a lot in the background. So I just remember you saying that. And again, just wanted to bring that up as a very disarming, like very like grounded memory that I have for getting to know you. And again, in a space where it can be very awkward, especially somebody younger in their career, meeting somebody that is in a space you're trying to learn more about. So I just want to thank you for that. And it really stood out for me.
I'm glad it did. those are always strange, and if I can do anything to like make people feel more comfortable about going to someone more senior in their career, happy to do it.
Yeah. Well, and then, so to that point on being more senior in your career, and I wanted to have you on too, because you've had such a decorated career and have made a lot of different shifts that I think most people might expect. And so would love to kind of have you walk through your career and then talk through some of the thought process. So maybe if you just want to start how you would talk about your career, what's your story?
Yeah. So I started out climbing the corporate ladder. Shockingly, many of my transitions were trying to follow a boy to Boston, actually. So I was an engineer at Virginia Tech, went to grad school at Pennsylvania for a master's engineering degree in industrial operations, tried to follow a boy to Boston, ended up in Chicago, working for McKinsey and Company in their operations practice. Then actually made it to Boston for business school. I went to Harvard Business School after I realized that like the long-term path of a full-time big three consultant was not my jam. Mm-hmm. And then in Boston, I was one of the very few that said, I don't want to work in a big, huge city. I don't want to be in consulting. I don't want to be in investment banking or in finance. I want to be in supply chain and operations. And so I ended up at Nike in Portland, awesome. Oregon, along with three other classmates at the time, and was at Nike for 7 years. Thought I was going to put my roots down in Portland and in 2015 hit a wall, personally, physically, spiritually, emotionally. I had been giving like climbing that corporate ladder very quickly and realized that I had nothing but my work and the detriment of friends and family and health and mental health. So I was in a job that's now like five jobs. It's one of the areas they invested in at Nike. I raised my hand. I said, get me the hell out or I'm going to get myself out. And then I started on a path of kind of reclaiming who I am in my career. Ended up getting a lateral move, a promotion actually to move to Charlotte, North Carolina, where I said, I want to move to Charlotte. And then the universe helped find me a job. My family is here on the East Coast. That's why I wanted to move back. Worked as a senior director of sales and operations planning, supply chain planning for an appliance manufacturer for 3 years until COVID happened. And there was no other time to jump. So I jumped. Now I'm a full-time entrepreneur.
Awesome. I mean, and very diverse, very mobile kind of background there, spanning a number of different companies. And I think you touched on some things I definitely want to dive into, but maybe can you talk a little bit more about some of those? You talked a lot about the pivots, but were there decision points or there's obviously a drive for each of those moves that you made. Were there other criteria that helped you know when it was the right time to make some of those moves? The boy thing maybe was one thing, but maybe the later career ones.
Well, in the first part of the career, the nice part about the consulting path and the business school path and the early stages of business or my corporate career, there were almost like checkpoints, just like in school, just like you're a freshman, sophomore, junior, senior at McKinsey, you did 2 years as an analyst, 2 to 3 years as an associate, 3 years as an engagement manager. Sometime after analyst or like your first year as associate, you go back to business school, which you do for 2 years. And I saw the same thing in Nike. I was labeled a hypo, which, you know, high potential, high performance, which meant that they moved you every 2 to 3 years. And so it was like schools, like you just made it to the next jump. But when you started to get to the director role, they might move you laterally, but then you have to, that's where I was like, oh shit, the next role is a senior director. And I looked at the senior directors at Nike and I'm like, I don't want their lives. I don't want that. Like I was a single person at the time there. I don't think I knew a single, not, I mean, a single, single person. Like that was a senior director. Yeah. Cause I was pretty young. I'd moved up pretty quickly. So all the senior directors, if they were men, they had wives at home. If they were female, they had their partners at home. Because at Nike, they worked you so hard that you had no time to take care of the household, nevertheless, if you had kids, right? And I was looking at that, I was like, I don't want that. And so that was the first time in my career where there was like not a next step that was inevitable to take. And that's where I was faced with choice for the first time. Like they, you know, they say one door, you know, you walk down the path, and what you don't realize is that when you walk down some of these paths is like just as many doors close as they do open. Like, you know, after McKinsey, you can't just like go work an entry level job somewhere. Right. And after business school, you got to pay off your debt. So you can't just like go work, you know, so you have like, there's a path to follow.
Yeah.
And so it was about, you know, once I'd finished the path, I was like, oh shit, there's just more path.
Yeah. There's some closed doors back here that I maybe want to go explore kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Huh. Maybe on the kind of the flip side of that, were there decisions? It sounds like a lot of this was very, I don't want to say scripted, but, you know, very prescriptive in terms of like, hey, this is how it's set up for you. Were there cases that you can think back to where maybe there was a point of choice that you didn't make?
I could have gone to Apple after business school. That was my summer internship. And I, instead of moving to San Francisco, I said, you know, I don't want to be on a bus an hour and a half every, it was like an hour and a half there and an hour and a half home. And I'm like, no, I can't do it. So I could have lived in the heart of San Francisco and been in that HBS alumni community. And instead I said, I don't want that. I want to move to Portland. And Nike wasn't actually interviewing for supply chain people. I went up to the recruiter and I said, hi, I want to work at Nike in supply chain. And like they weren't, that was before they started their massive MBA recruiting push. So I was kind of the entry point.
Okay.
It happened to be that like I had like, you know, the pedigree that would get me in the door, like, you know, McKinsey background, engineering, like the perfect GPA. Like literally I had a perfect GPA out of undergrad. So like I had everything, you know, I had like the perfect recipe for them to kind of hand pick me and move me through the interview process. But that was the first choice of like, oh, there's a default path that I'm supposed to take and I'm going to choose something different.
And was it, when you think back, was it largely that, hey, this commute, this lifestyle just doesn't really fit for what I was looking for?
The commute, the lifestyle, but also I realized that like, I wasn't my best self when I was at business school. I was trying to keep up with the Joneses. And, that was like the first sign. I'm like, oh, like I am not happy with myself. And if I go down that default path that everyone else goes down, I'm going to continue to lose myself a little bit. Portland was the first choice that I said, this is, I'm not going to go down the path that I'm supposed to. I'm going to pick something different.
It's great, like bit of self-awareness. It sounds like from when you were telling your story too, you kind of came back to that same kind of conclusion or a similar conclusion, like, oh, this isn't, I'm not me. There's parts of my life that I'm not able to live out.
Yeah, I can articulate that now, but I basically knew like I was miserable in my second year of business school. And I was like, oh, if I just like follow what everyone else is doing, I'm going to stay miserable. I didn't have language to know what it was. That has come after many, many years of therapy and coaching and the holistic self journey that I went on afterwards. But I was like, at that time, I was like, move away from things that make me miserable.
Right. If it hurts, stop doing it. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. That's exactly where I was.
Yeah. Maybe a quick diversion before we get back more into that. For maybe those that are unfamiliar, just to again kind of paint the scene for different kinds of functions and different kinds of work that's available out there. Can you talk a little bit more about the S&OP or supply chain planning kind of broader practice, S&OP, S&OP plus, IBP kind of thing?
Yeah. So in sales and operations planning, what we're doing is essentially balancing demand, what we're going to sell, and predicting that with supply. What do we need to either manufacture or make? And so S&OP sits at the intersection of the functions that influence demand, sales, marketing, brand, the intersections of the functions that influence supply, manufacturing, global sourcing, and the implication of balance, supply and demand balancing is finance. So, you know, you make money, you spend money, and people, right? You know, HR is always involved, especially when you are looking at, you know, what the, you know, if you decide to like make less, there's less people. So, you know, finance, we dealt with P&Ls and cash management. So working at, one of the nice parts about Nike is I worked in the women's training division in their, I was a demand planner, but essentially served as their S&OP function. And so I worked with the marketing teams, the brand teams, the launch teams, the stores teams, the sales teams, the global supply planning teams, the that was all produced at the time when I worked at Electrolux. We worked a lot with the factory teams. Like, you know, if you are run out of raw materials for something, like it doesn't matter what you want to sell. Like, that's one of the reasons I quit during COVID. I'm like, just no winning here.
Right.
But it was a role that required cross-functional knowledge of all the players, all the processes, S&OP, you're thinking essentially Nike, it was six seasons in flight. You had to think about the season that had just sold that you were liquidating. What does that imply for the season that is currently selling? And how do those implications go into what you're selling in to your, our retailers? What you're planning from a line planning perspective and what like the strategy is. And so S&OP was one of those functions where you had to have like a accordion mind of like what's happening now impacts things that are going to be in the market 2 years from now. And the strategy of what someone's bringing down the pipe 2 years from now is going to impact what actually needs to be decided on for things in the market now. So it was a very cross-functional role that give you a ton of access to but also a requirement of understanding, like basically the entire business.
Yeah. So, I mean, and I think you maybe alluded to that a little bit. What kind of careers do you say lend themselves into leaning into that, or interests or even appetites for that kind of work? Like what makes a good candidate for somebody looking at that kind of space?
So if you want to be in one of the functions, I think it's just having like a detail oriented mindset, if you want to work in like kind of the higher up planning, S&OP, it's, I think the things that are most important are, the skills that you need are more of the, cross-functional, understanding how to turn data into insights and like what matters, like strategic planning and distillation. Like, sure, like sales cares about the delivery of that particular item, but you know, it's margin, you know, it doesn't matter, right? Like, sure, someone customer is going to get pissed at you, but you can't care. You have to be able to focus on prioritization. And this like holistic concept of systems thinking is like a decision one function makes that optimizes that function is going to sub-optimize another function. So the qualities that make for a good S&OP person is someone that understands the heartbeat of an organization and the rhythms of every function in it. And the systems thinking about like, how am I optimizing for the good of the whole versus, optimizing a single function? But any function, any of those functions, as long as you're like math oriented, I wouldn't suggest someone in marketing, you know, like you gotta, you know, be comfortable and fluent, like manufacturing metrics and demand planning metrics, but really any of those functions leads into S&OP, but it's more of the quality of, can you think about multivariate problems and so, like, you know, recognizing where, how to play the politics and, you know, what matters essentially. Like if you're someone who like operates in black and white, S&OP is not for you, but you have to operate in wild zones of gray because you have to be able to distill all the information that is coming at you to be like, this is what my senior leadership needs to care about. This is going to move the needle. And that's that quality, but that can come from any of those functions.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause it sounds like it challenges that idea that it's either depth or breadth. It's both. Breadth, but also depth. And then also that discernment to say like, okay, I understand enough and I can pick out what's important and what we should use to make decisions. Cause it sounds like it'd be really easy to get paralyzed. Also sounds like there's a fair amount of that interpersonal aspect of you've got to dance in between the different functions. So kind of the all-star kind of role.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I think on that note too, it sounds like, and even as you talked about, it's clear that like you're passionate about that kind of work. So you're still doing some of that now, right? As in a consulting role, less anchored to a specific company.
Well, I just finished up my last S&OP consulting gig, but I'm a full-time small business consultant. So I work with expertise-based businesses to help them improve their business foundations, which a lot of that is systems thinking about your pricing, your offers, your premise and methodology for like how you know, I work with a lot of coaches. I work with a lot of copywriters and marketing agencies and financial services agencies and holistic healers and executive coaches. I know I said that already, but I work with a couple.
Yeah.
And like management trainers. And it's all thinking about it from a systems perspective. Like a lot of, I would say like someone who's like an expert in marketing, for example, is going to understand how to run Facebook ads. My job is with my clients to say, how do we think about what marketing strategy is right for you, given what kind of business you're trying to run? And how do we, again, take that systems perspective on putting in the right infrastructure, the right rhythms, the right priorities? Again, could I have explained S&OP like this without having spent the last 3 years in my consulting role? No, S&OP at that point, I was like, you got to know a lot about a whole lot of things and be able to hold a shit ton of information in your head about what's going on in the company and then get everyone else to agree with you on a path forward and like herd the cats. Like you just have to herd the cats.
And then do it again next month.
Ideally, like I'm doing my last implementation with another company and I'm like, half the meeting is making a decision and half the meeting is about teeing up the decisions that they're going to need to make next month, which means you need to be thinking about the next 3 months of decisions.
Yeah.
Unless something like shows up as a fire, literally sometimes a fire.
Right.
But like you're kind of always playing like the 2 to 3 months game of like, you're going to have to make this decision next month. I'm giving you notice so you can like marinate about it and think about it. So I don't have to put you on the spot, but it's coming. And so that's like, you can't just look at the now, you have to look at the what's next. And that's what I help my clients do is like, okay, like this is what we're doing now, but like, I'm always thinking about the roadmap 3 to 4 steps ahead.
Yeah. It sounds great too. Cause it seems like you're able to distill a lot of what you've taken from experience and kind of treat it as a very focused and concentrated and directed, almost like almost like MBA kind of thing, like, cool, you know this, let me teach you the rest of what's there as it applies to you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's very close to what I do. Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think would love to talk about maybe more on that shift that you mentioned when you were at Nike, you made the decision like, hey, this is, I need to go find something different for me. What were some of the cues that you kind of mentioned, like, hey, I don't want this next path, but I'm also looking for balance in different areas. And I think you even talked about too, that realization of rejecting the toxic productivity kind of culture. So,
yep. So we'll set the stage. It was 2015. It was in like October. There was a role at Nike called inventory operations in the geography. And it was one of these like pressure cooker roles. At the end of the quarter, you got grilled literally up and down the entire like leadership team about like where your inventory was. I've been in the role for like 2 months. And this was at a time when we were just transitioning distribution centers. Like we just transitioned last year. And through the transition, like $4 million or something like that of like our return to vendor shoes were like off the book somewhere. So we'd been underreporting inventory. I mean, it wasn't technically our inventory, but it was like a whole thing.
Yeah.
And I was new. The manager working for me was new and he went on paternity leave. So I had to do the entire quarter close process by myself. I was like addicted to my phone. I couldn't leave because like, oh my God, what if someone needed something? So I couldn't go anywhere because I needed to be near my computer for like 2 weeks. And I was like, the 6 months before that, I was abusing alcohol in not a great fashion. And then it all came to a head like the week before Thanksgiving. I had like basically a meltdown panic attack crying jag in my boss's office for like 2 weeks or like a week. It was like, I think I cried in his office and then I cried in a bunch, literally every other of the inventory people's offices. I was like, okay, something's like literally wrong here.
Yeah.
Physically. So I took the whole next week of Thanksgiving off and I was like, okay, like there have been signals, there have been signs. And this was like the
right.
You cannot ignore this as a call.
Yeah. So how did you then translate that recognition or awareness of the call into like, what steps did you take to kind of move in there? It wasn't an overnight kind of thing. Cause I think we met after that even.
Yeah. So the next steps, I was in Portland, Oregon, and there's during my week off, I think I went to two places. I went and bought a plant. I had no life in a condo. I had just moved into a condo and my condo was like bare and sad because I was never there. And when I was there, I was always working.
Yeah.
But the other turning point was I went into the giant bookstore called Powell's and I was like, I need to do something that's not work. And they had an event board of all the events. Mm-hmm. And there was this mind, body, spirit expo happening at like the convention center or something like that. I was not spiritual at the time, but I was like, well, this seems like something else. I was again, like very much like moving to Portland seemed like the not HBS thing to do.
Yeah.
Like, I'm like, oh, I'm miserable. So let's do like something else.
Right.
So I was like, well, I'm miserable in corporate. That's not corporate.
Right.
Let's go do that.
Yeah.
And then at that point I found like this person that did energy work and I didn't know anything about energy work. I think earlier that year or later, like around the corner that I went and saw like a tarot person.
Yeah.
Because I just knew that there was like something in me. I think I picked up like Jen Sincero's book called You Are a Badass. And she talked about like meditation and manifestation a little bit in that. And then also at the expo was an advertisement for a holistic nutrition program. Mm-hmm. It was an East meets West kind of Chinese medicine grounded nutrition program. And I'm like, well, my health is shit. And it's a weekend program and it's not the first weekend of the month because I had to work the first weekend of the month. And I'm like, this seems like something that will distract me from my career.
Yeah.
But like, it was all those things. It was like getting me out of my house and getting me out of my work body and putting me in like, I'm like, okay, like, I don't want that. So I'm going to do the entirely different opposite thing. And I'm just going to like, keep doing things that are not the default path for me.
Yeah. And on that, I mean, I think feel free if this is like, let me know if this is too personal. Wondering if you wouldn't mind talking about kind of what that decision process was, or that thought process as you kind of saw like, oh, this is not what's hurting me. I'm going to try this. I kind of like this. Maybe what's hurting me, I need to step away from. Because I think all these things are very like prestigious, and a ton of people aspire to work for Nike or have that kind of pedigree and that background. What was it like to kind of consciously step away from that? Was there this identity, like questioning of your identity in any of that?
I would say it wasn't it was definitely a recognition that like I didn't have languages for this time. I was like, I'm miserable. I'm doing something else.
Yeah.
And it was, as I started to move more towards, like, I took the holistic nutrition class and I'm like, this is interesting. And then I said, well, I want to help more people. So I want to become a life coach. So I became a life coach. And I think it was literally learning in like my life coaching certification that like I had limiting beliefs and I had like internal beliefs about my life and patterns that I was running on script. But I like, there's a lot of like Nike at that time, like that had that, like, you know, you were there like culturally. Yeah. Like I moved out of the geography and I moved into a global role, and that was miserable. Cause it was super boring. And so like when I moved out of the job, that was like the high pressure cooker job, into a job that's kind of one of those bullshit jobs. I had lots of time.
Sure.
To figure out that, like, to like observe more. And I'm like, oh, okay. I'm running some patterns, and I couldn't pick another job I wanted. So the identity shift came later.
Yeah.
But it was more like continued. I spent a couple more years moving down the path I didn't want. I'm like, okay, but if I don't want that, I'm just going to keep moving away from that.
Sure.
I would say I didn't have what I was moving to until I moved into the life coaching world and actually had someone help me confront my belief systems.
Yeah.
I did have some of this sounds a little egotistical, going to say it anyways, yeah. But once you have the pedigree on your books, you're allowed a lot more freedom.
Sure.
To do other things. Yes and no, like you're constrained. Like if I were to like, just like quit my job and like work at the grocery store, I think that would, you know, raise some eyebrows, but, you know, I, you know, you don't ever like, you know, you can't return the pedigree. So I thought I'd like leverage it to like, gain a little more latitude to do some interesting things.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think it sounded egotistical. Like it's you're putting to use the investment that you've made, and the experiences that you've had. So absolutely. Yeah. I think I'd like to talk to you about maybe, along that vein of, and maybe it's come through as you've coached others. What's advice that you would give for folks as they are looking for finding the right career for them or making that next career move? What are the kinds of considerations that maybe you've taken yourself or that you would help others work through as you coach them?
I think it's really important to, and I talk about this with my business clients, but also, it became really apparent at Nike that, everyone thinks that up is the right move, and financially it is for a lot of people. But every job you take up changes the nature of the job, because we don't, like, if you're a fantastic individual contributor, management of a group of individuals is going to be different. Leading a small team, managing a department. Like, I didn't know it until I started moving through the ranks and being like, oh, like they don't teach you how to manage. I had to learn all that on my own. They don't teach you how to lead a department. I had to learn all that on my own. And as I got more senior, I realized that like part of the reason I didn't want the senior director job is because you didn't actually get to do stuff.
You didn't get to
have your hands on the work, because you're supposed to delegate it to your directors. And I'm like, well, I'm good at the work. Like that was my zone of genius, like stems somewhat from like having my hands in the data. And if all I'm going to do is like make PowerPoints all day long and like go sit in meetings and like pass, that's kind of what they like, you know, you're playing politics and passing PowerPoints around. And, you know, just like at consulting, like, you know, you engagement managers manage the project, but then associate partners and directors, they sell. They build the relationships, and you don't get to manage the projects. And so I think it's really important to remove the conflation between title and money and what you like to do. Mm-hmm. And there are some places that will reward expertise, but it might not come in the trappings of a big team.
Yeah.
So that's one piece that's really, I think, really important. And I think the other part is like, you know, we live in a culture that is, we're just drowning in information. We're just drowning in information mm-hmm. and in content. And everyone, you know, everyone knows this, like, you know, the highlight reel, but I think all of these practices are designed to strip us from our bodies. Mm. They're designed to put us in our heads, to put us on our phones, to remove us from those natural. I think that's what I learned in kind of like that holistic nutrition. That was what was really exciting is like I had embodied practices. I was cooking. I was using a hot bottle warmer. I was learning about, and I was looking at my tongue and I was like checking my pulse. And that was those things. I started like working with tarot cards, and these were all embodied ritualistic practices that were somatic in nature and not just intellectual, not mm-hmm. electronic. And I think, you know, maintaining that connection to nature, maintaining that connection to the body, and maintaining that like connection with source, whatever that means for you, is really important to avoid getting pulled by the default narratives.
Yeah, I think too, I mean, you alluded to it too, finding that system that you can be a part of that allows for that headspace where you're not all, it's not all consuming, and you can actually afford yourself that space. Yeah. And I think maybe on the, back to the topic you mentioned of like up being the way that everybody thinks you should go. And I mean, again, we were both together in a large culture that I think one of the positive things is it talks a lot about career development and career mapping, and you talk to other people and you go and you network. What advice would you give to somebody that is trying to craft a career map in a way that you don't, that doesn't need to be linear and always in an upward trajectory? What kind of advice would you give and how to construct that? And then I'm going to flip it and say, what advice would you give as a leader for how to interpret that and not just assume like, great, I'm meeting with somebody, where's their career map showing they want to be a VP in 5 years?
Yeah. Well, one, I always had a career map showing I wanted to be a VP at the end, because that's just how you play the game. But the second part was, it's a couple of things. One is, I think everyone races up their next rung. And again, you miss out if you try to race up that too fast. A lot of times, like, one, you're not a peer with your, like, it was hard being, I was much younger. All my peers had kids. They were all like 10 years older than me. Like, my social group at work, because I didn't really have a social group outside of work, but like my age group peers were my interns and my direct reports. So like I couldn't be friends with them necessarily because I was a manager, a leader to them. There's a hierarchical difference. But I didn't like fit. I wasn't in the same stage of life as like some of the peers that were my colleagues. I mean, some of them are my best friends today still, but you know, it was hard. But I think like, if you race up to try to get from like individual contributor to manager, to you miss out on the lateral moves that actually make you much more well-rounded as a leader. Because you see, again, like once you're a director, you stop seeing the trenches. So like, don't just like have up moves, have very intentional, circular, like lateral moves, and then make all like campaign for the roles you want. And say, this is how it fits into my learning development plan. So like, I had a geo role, I had a global role, I had a demand planning role. They had at Nike, they had these things that were called core experiences that were, again, like cross-functional, like you have to hit some of these like core roles to move up. Because if you didn't have that, like, you know, integral experience, you would have always been on like the fringe functions, never in like the core function. So you had a limit. But I think intentionally being like, I want a job that does project management. I want a job that does process management. I want a job where I'm doing daily in the grind work. Like, you know, if you just take project management jobs, you're never going to get a senior leader job that like manages the business, because you've never been in the business. You've always been in project management or process management roles.
Yeah. How do you, or what advice do you have for campaigning for the right role and looking for the right role and thinking you might know what that next right role is, but if it isn't available, like what's your philosophy on waiting it out, finding the right next, like waiting for the right role versus, hey, now's the time to move, How do you balance that?
You tell people what you want.
Mm.
Tell people the roles you want. Tell people, I want that job. I want these types of jobs. It's like you've heard of the reticular activation system?
No. Mm-mm.
It's, you know, like when you say like, oh, I have a red car now, and then all you see are red cars.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
It works for what you want out of life, but also like your managers are busy people, and like when we are there in a big organization, they have career development conversations, and then they actively talk about where they want to move people. And if no one knows where you want to go, you don't get talked about.
Yeah.
So like maybe the role's not there, but you can't just be like, I want that because it's got prestige. I want to know why you want it. I want to know how this fits in and what are your alternatives? Like, I want that job, but also I want someone that does the homework that says, I want this learning experience. And so this role fits that learning experience. And so does that. And so does that. And so does that. So I want someone who isn't just like saying, I want this job for money. Yeah, that's fine too. But like, I want someone who's like intentional to say, this is the next skill I need to learn. And this is the next edge I need to hone. And these are the types of roles that fit that. And the minute someone tells me what they need as a good leader, now as a shitty leader, I can't say what they do, but as a good leader, you're like, how can I make that happen for them? So when I was at Electrolux, which was my last employer, I had career development conversations with all of my team members. And one of my direct reports, he was my demand planning manager. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I want to get director. We talked about what he was looking for. He's like, I really want to lead through managers. And his career track ended up having him take my job someday, which never actually happened because of, you know, COVID and lots of things and change. But he's like, in order for me to get that job, I need to have supply planning experience. So part of the 3-year transformation I led for my organization was trying to get everyone the job they wanted. I moved all my, the demand planners, I moved some of them to supply planning because they wanted cross-functional experience. Some supply planners, I moved to demand planning. Some people I were able to get promoted. I crafted a whole new job for him.
Yeah.
Because I was like, we're going to need it. And I think he's a good fit. And so like, but that only part of that happened is because he's like, this is what I want. I'm like, cool. Now I know. And I can make it happen.
Yeah. I really like that because I think it challenges that idea of, hey, how do you build your career map? That's like, this is the role that I want, which will give me this role, which will give me this role. It's like, what experiences do I want? What skills do I want to acquire so that I can do this kind of work? I think that's a really important challenge.
Yeah. And all of my jobs, like all the ones that were on my job, I was like, I'm going to make shit up that doesn't belong here. Like it's not here yet, but that doesn't mean it won't be here. But it was more of a, they don't care. Like there's only like a handful of VP jobs, but you can be like, I wanted to be the VP of the digital transformation. I wanted to be VP of this. And I made up jobs. Like they don't have to be real jobs that they're like in 10 years, they're going to be.
Right.
So I'm going to say what I want.
Yeah.
I'm going to say like, what types of leadership roles would I want? Like, I'm like, I don't want to run a P&L, but what else could I do that's at that title level that is in like that more of like that expert role versus the manager of an organization role.
Yeah. I think too, doing that helps to open up or talking the skills and like kind of the things you want to do help again for good managers or good people on the receiving end of those can help to say, oh, you've thought about these. Have you thought about this? This also might hold this for you. So how can I help steer you in a direction or open your eyes to something that you maybe didn't know existed? So.
Exactly. Yep. That's the, you know, everyone is exhausted. Everyone is tired. If you expect someone to develop you without you doing the healthy work to be like, here's where I need to develop. And oh, by the way, I'm going to take on some of this. Nike talks about the 70-20-10, 70% on the job training, 20% mentorship, and then 10% learning. Like I spent tens of thousands of dollars on coaching, and part of my coaching was how to be a better manager. And that was not paid for by my company, but you know what that did? It made me a better manager.
Yeah.
And I think I actually was the only one that ever came into like my career conversations with my CFO. I reported to the CFO when I was at Electrolux, and I'm like, here's my development plan. Here's what I'm doing every quarter.
Yeah.
And here's my 70%. Here's my projects that I'm working on. Here's my mentorship. And here's my personal development that I'm doing. He's like, can you make this template for everybody else? And I'm like, yes, I can. And I did.
As a matter of fact, and this is something that I enjoy doing, and I'd like to do this. And by the way, this is now what I want to do.
And I got to, I got to lead the strategy planning session for the finance function at Electrolux for 2 years. Guess what I do now? I lead strategy planning for organizations. like people, like they want to help light you up. You just have to, everyone is so overloaded that they can't help you if you don't help tell them what you need.
Yeah. I think too, like what you just said there as well, like, hey, this is what I want to do. And I was able to bring it to life. Like, I think that's the freedom that I don't think people talk about as much, or like you said, hey, they're not going to tell you every step that you need to take along the way. But if once you find something that you want to do, if you can bring it to life, then that can open up doors that you didn't know existed otherwise. So how do you make the most of what you have, whether it's resources on the job or the freedom?
A lot of times you just got to ask. One of my best projects was at Nike was I was working in demand planning, and my boss is like frustrated by the reporting. And I'm like, he's like, I'll issue a challenge. Who can make this reporting better? And I took it and I ran. I put together process documentation. I put together a project plan and I put together like scoping dashboards. And I'm like, can you help me get this built? He gave me like, there was a North America Innovation Fund at the time. Mm-hmm. And they sponsored my Tableau dashboard development. They gave me a consultant to help project management. As long as I would like run it.
Yeah.
They would, and they like dedicated a bunch of time from the data team and, you know, a couple hundred thousand dollars. But I did this on top of like my demand planning job.
Yeah.
And it was the best thing in my career at Nike.
Yeah. Yeah. One of those extra things that's not on the job description. So I think too, that openness that you talk about, like, how do you keep an open mind to think about those things and be curious? It sounds like too, to look for different opportunities. I think you talked about, you know, you'd gone through and gotten a life coaching certification. We talked about pedigree. I'm interested in your thoughts on how you build credibility and your thoughts on certifications and training. And like you mentioned, you've gone and gotten coaching. Like, what recommendations or advice would you give to people in their careers for finding that balance between credibility through letters you can put at the end of your name or degrees you've got from certain places? How important is that in the mix of everything?
The degree gets you in the door sometimes and certification, mm-hmm. It's just the price of admission, but if you're not good when you get there, doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So, I would say like, make sure if you want to do corporate coaching, get yourself a certification that's ICC, ICF accredited, and you can be your ACC. Some of that's just like the table stakes to like play in the corporate game.
Yeah.
But then it's about, okay, like, it's like once you've gotten the game, then you have to earn your place. And that is where skill development comes into play. So like I did an ICF accredited life coaching school and it was fine, but it was very head centric. And I was like, I don't think I'm good enough. And so I went out and sought out another life coaching certification that was kind of like head, heart, body, environment. And it was very like, there was like things on the environment and nervous system management and the chakra system and trauma and somatic work. And I'm like, okay, this is what I was missing from my coaching practice. And I didn't need it to be certified. I was certified coach, but I needed it to be good at my craft. And I take a lot of, I have my Harvard background, but like, that just like gets me in the door, but nothing I do now is from what I learned at Harvard.
Yeah.
Like at Harvard, all I learned was like how to like speak in front of a group of 90 people and not black out really. and like learn the basics of accounting, but online marketing and storytelling and copywriting and, you know, the frameworks around pricing and offer structure and buyer psychology. I don't learn any of that in business school. I'm learning that all afterwards because my goal is to, as Cal Newport says, be so good they can't ignore you.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like, yeah, that like, I kind of have like three, you have, bought, borrowed, earned. Built, borrowed, earned. Sorry.
Okay.
Like built is, I have had the transformation. I have actually guided people through the transformation. Borrowed is HBS. It's McKinsey. It's like, I'm trafficking on their, credibility. Like it's not mine. Sure. It's borrowed.
Yeah.
And then earned is like, okay, once you've had that credibility, it's when people select you to be featured on places and you get press coverage and you're selected as a keynote speaker for things because you've earned the keynote.
Yeah. Like you're only an expert when someone invites you into their life to
exactly.
As one. Yeah.
And so like sometimes you just need the trappings of borrowed credibility just to get yourself in the door. But if you're not able to build that social proof on your own, and you're not able to kind of demonstrate that value, then it, you know, the other, but you can build that credibility without having the borrow credibility. It's just a little harder and like requires a little more elbow grease.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. I think I like to wrap up with a few kind of broader questions.
Sure.
So I think, can you share maybe what the coolest thing you've done in your career? Coolest thing. I mean, you mentioned the most fun you had on a project at Nike, but what's the coolest thing that stands out for whatever reason?
Oh, the coolest thing. Okay. So when I, this was back in the heyday of Nike. So I was on the women's training team and North America leadership team had an offsite in Los Angeles, and it was only VPs except for the category leadership team. So I got to go to this offsite in LA, and my entire women's leadership team, we all, that they had a party every night, every, every, you know, celebration of the Maxims is what they were called. And we all put on white dresses, the same Nike sneakers because it was sneaker ball. We got to ride into a, in a limo to the Dolby Theater, which is where they have the Oscars for a party.
Very cool.
Yeah. Nike doesn't do that anymore. I don't think they do. I don't know. They're probably trying to cut costs.
That's awesome. So maybe what's one thing, and you've given a lot of really great advice throughout all of this and kind of tidbits, but maybe what's one thing, if you had to distill it down to one, that you'd wish you'd learned earlier on in your career? Maybe it was a mistake or a miscalculation or just something that you would want to share with others.
I'll give you two things. One is like, be really, really cautious of drinking just in general.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I think that, that was something that's like career related, but like, it's just, it was really indoctrinated at the culture of McKinsey. It was really indoctrinated to the culture of business school and at Nike. And I think that like certainly didn't help me like feeling, and then I think the other one is again, be explicit with your learning. Like, don't just go for the next job. Think about your learning objective for this arc of your career. What skills do you need to learn? What experiences do you need to have that are going to set you up? And I think there's kind of this concept of like no fail moves. Like there, like there's no like, okay, like in this job or this job or this job, everyone like chooses jobs. And I'm like, well, you're going to learn basic skills in those places. So like what it looks like doesn't necessarily matter. Go work for a good manager in a job where you can learn these skills and go hunt the skill learning as much as like being good at the job.
Yeah, no, that's great. Well, cool. Thank you so much for being on. I want to give you a chance. Where can people learn more about what you're doing? How can they get in touch? I know you've got a newsletter. Where can they subscribe to that?
Yeah. So again, I work with expertise businesses, you know, at the beyond the basics of starting. So, you know, your coaches that are, you know, had their first handful of clients and that are looking to really build a business that's sustainable, even if it's not scalable. And they can find me at jessicalackey.com. And they go to jessicalackey.com/welcome. They can sign up for my newsletter where each week is a deep dive into actionable business strategies that are helping us to be, grow more sustainably.
Awesome. I can say personally, been on the mailing list for a while. Those are very content rich, very useful newsletters. So thank you for providing those. So
it's fun. I love it. Yeah. That's my personal outlet.
Yeah. This is great. Jessica, thanks for so much for being on. It was great to talk.
It's great too.
Though it had been some time since I'd last spoken with Jessica, it was great to catch up with her, and I found my time with her now just as insightful and energizing as I remembered my first conversation with her. In particular, I love what she said about credentials and how in some cases those just end up being table stakes to get your name into the mix. But it was the actual meaningful application of the skills behind those credentials that allow you to excel at your craft. For more details on what some of those credentials could be, and if you're interested in pursuing certifications of your own, which you should then follow up with practical application, of course, I suggest you check out episode 18 on third-party certifications. The other idea that I loved was the build, borrowed, and earn framework, and that you could break up aspects of your career and lived experience into a way that helps you to understand and analyze where you may need to focus if you're looking to grow your career. This way of thinking about your experiences fits nicely into the kind of career map that I talk about in the first few episodes of this podcast. And once you identify where you may need to build up on your career, you can easily apply some of the concepts from the Harada method from episode 6 to bring those to life. And that about does it. So as always, if you have any thoughts or questions or ideas you'd like to hear covered in future episodes, you can send them to me at patrick@prgscoach.com. If you also have a unique career story of your own or feel as though you have something to offer to the world as far as career development advice goes, I'd love to hear from you and maybe feature you on a future career deep dive episode. And with that, I'll sign off with a certain type of perfection can only be realized through the limitless accumulation of the imperfect. Thanks again for listening in, and we'll talk more in our next episode.